The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I thought I would talk a little bit today about the whole notion of Buddhist teachers and hope that it's interesting for some of you. In our particular tradition of Buddhism, the Theravadan tradition here in the West, or the Insight Meditation Movement, we call the teachers teachers. And in other traditions, they have other, in English, they have other terms. In San Francisco Zen Center, there are people there are called priests, or sometimes they're called teachers. Sometimes like a senior Dharma teacher is someone who is quite senior there without being an abbot. But they also have the word priest. There are another, in Tibetan traditions, they have lamas and gurus, or especially lamas and rinpoches that are used. But even in Asia, the word teacher seems to be often the preferred common word for teachers in Buddhism, spiritual leaders, the clergy, or whatever. And the word acharya became in Thai ajahn, the way that words morph into Thai. Or Thai pronunciations of the Sanskrit or Pali. And acharya means teacher. The word guru, apparently in Indian, also just means teacher, like your professor might be your guru. And so it has kind of a broader meaning than just a spiritual teacher. And in Japan, we have sensei, which is sometimes used for also for Zen teachers. They're called senseis. And so the idea of teacher. And the word teacher is distinct from words like priest or minister. Priest, historically, at least in Catholicism, was someone who mediated between you and God. And that was a really ritual role, was really important for that mediation. And Protestantism was a protest against that mediation process. And so people would have their own direct relationship with God, unmediated. And so then they stopped using the word priest in Protestantism, and now they use minister or pastor or something. But even the word minister, I think, at least in my mind, has connotations of taking care of the pastoral needs of a congregation, ministering to people. Whereas a teacher has the idea that there's something to impart, something to teach. When you're taught something, you leave with it. If you've been ministered, it might be comforting and very meaningful in many ways, but you're not left with a set of tools or a set of understandings that are portable, that you can take with you wherever you go. Whereas with a teacher, the idea is that you are, you know, it's quite portable, you take it with you. I like to say that, or at least think that in Buddhism, that the job of a teacher is to talk yourself out of a job, and to become unnecessary at least. And there's so many people so there's probably unlikely, but at least with individuals, that the idea you become unnecessary for that individual because they've internalized or developed the teachings, the practices for themselves, and they become in some sense independent. And the expression, powerful expression, I think, in Buddhism, is the idea of someone becoming independent in the Dharma. So you see or experience the Dharma in such a personal, direct way that you become independent in it. And there's far back ago this test goes, but there's a so-called test that if someone's been around practicing for a long time, that they can be given. And that is, the test would be, if the Buddha came back and said, he walked into IMC one day and said, hey, I've thought about this for a while and I was wrong. So what would you do? What would your response be to that? And now I shouldn't give you the answer, but the answer has to do with that doesn't matter what the Buddha says. That you've understood something for yourself, that is so direct and so immediate, so verified for yourself, that you know that for yourself that that's true. So this idea that, you know, that you're supposed to become independent in the Dharma is kind of a goal in practice. So in our particular tradition, we've continued using the word teacher for people who are teaching, as opposed to other things. But certainly that's the role of teacher encompasses many other things. And so the things like being a pastor, being a minister, being a priest, are kind of all there kind of on the, you know, on the edges of it. Buddhist teachers do mediate between, not God, but between what's sacred or what's considered sacred. And they do rituals, for example. Sometimes they do minister or do pastoral counseling for people, and they come and support them in times of crisis and do that kind of role, or help run, help kind of caretake a community like a congregation the way a minister would. So, you know, it's not a hard and fast, these categories, but the emphasis is kind of being a teacher. What it also means is that there's a kind of a hierarchy involved, as there is any time there's a teacher-student relationship. A teacher knows something a student doesn't know. And so a student who wants to learn from a teacher approaches a teacher with a certain degree of respect or a certain degree of willingness to learn, and it puts them a little bit unequal footing. Until the student has learned what the teacher has to teach, or until the student has surpassed the teacher and then is teaching the teacher. And so that's true, you know, if you want to go learn a foreign language, you know, there's a kind of a hierarchy there in terms of learning that language. If you want to learn how to use a computer, and, you know, you don't know much about it and someone else knows a lot, then, you know, at least for me, I would revere them. Temporarily, I would, you know, treat them with great respect and appreciation and be in awe of their wonderful skill. But the... you know, there's a kind of hierarchy that goes on. So there's a hierarchy. And that hierarchy is one that some people in Western culture do not feel comfortable with. And to some degree, I've also internalized that discomfort and prefer not to have so much of it. And in my early years of teaching, tried very much to, in many ways, to try to lessen as much as I could that sense of a hierarchy that was there. Some people are very strong egalitarian ethos and refuse to want to have anybody as a teacher because it implies that your relationship to Buddhist teachers or spiritual teachers, because it implies that someone knows more than you do. Someone has more access than you do to spirituality, spiritual truth, spiritual something, practice. And that goes against the grain in some circles. I've seen it sometimes in Quaker circles, where I think Quakerism is really beautiful. I'm inspired by it quite a bit. But there I've seen there's a very strong culture, at least in the circles I've seen, a very strong egalitarianism where in a certain kind of Quakerism, there's no ministers, there's no priests. They're all priests. They're all ministers or something. What are they called there? Anyway. Well, they're called friends also, but they're also, everyone's...
We have not acknowledged the clergy. We have not abolished the clergy. We have abolished the laity.
Oh, they haven't abolished... Oh, the Quakers haven't abolished the clergy. They've abolished the laity. Meaning that everybody is clergy equally. So that's one way of seeing it. So I think that's beautiful. I'm inspired by that kind of idea. But still, it's part of the kind of cultural fabric that contributes to some people feeling uncomfortable with the hierarchy. If anything, here in the West, the tendency is to want to lessen the hierarchy, I think, between student and spiritual teachers. Sometimes in Asia, the tendency to heighten that hierarchy. And sometimes it becomes imbalanced in that direction too much, where the teacher is revered to no end, and sometimes foolishly. So where's the right balance of what the student-teacher relationship is? It's a very interesting one to consider. And that, in order to consider that, we need to consider a little bit, what does a teacher do? What's the role of a teacher? In Buddhism, at least. In Buddhist practice. And one of the roles is to be a didactic teacher who simply imparts certain knowledge that people should have who want to practice or want to be interested in Buddhism. So, it's a kind of knowledge you can pick up from a book as well, but who conveys this body of knowledge like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the history of Buddhism, the life of the Buddha, and it's possible to impart that very matter-of-factly and even in a very boring way, but to get the message across. This is the knowledge you should have. It also is an instructor who instructs in particular practices a person can do, so particular ways of behaving. So we can give instructions in meditation, and we have a lot of people who are meditation instructors who might not be Buddhist teachers at all, but they teach the basic practices of mindfulness, for example. And they impart it without really, people don't really think of them so much as a spiritual teacher, but they have a particular body of practices that they understand well enough to instruct other people in those practices. We have a whole slew of people now here in America called mindfulness-based MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction teachers. And some of them have had no retreat practice at all, have not really done a lot. Some people have done very little meditation practice on their own. What they've done is they've gone and done a course, a week-long course or something in mindfulness-based stress reduction. And they teach mindfulness without a lot of personal experience of it, but they're instructing or passing on to people how to do this. So that's part of a role of a Buddhist teacher, is to be an instructor. Another part is part of kind of like being an instructor plus is as people engage in whatever practice they're doing, the teacher is a guide and a support and a mentor for the process people go through. So there are challenges people encounter as they meditate or engage in practice. There are further steps to go as they go deeper. And so you're a guide or a mentor for the different unfoldings that might happen. As meditation deepens, it's good to have access to someone who experiences and knows some of the deeper things that can go on in meditation so they can support and mentor you and help you through that. And one of the most common roles for a Vipassana teacher like myself in terms of mentoring people is to normalize people's experience. Occasionally people have unusual things, but mostly my job is to normalize, it's okay what's going on, and then to encourage them to keep practicing. But to know the territory well is important. Then there is a whole other level of being a teacher, which is in some ways for people who are new, to initiate them not to a practice, not to a teaching, but to a way of being, a way of life. And so that's a little bit more nebulous how that is imparted. But sometimes you get a sense that a teacher represents a certain capacity that you have. That person has a certain inner stability, certain inner maturity, or a certain way of being in the world that maybe is with compassion or kindness, or has a certain peace, or is no longer caught up in the kind of things that what in Buddhism is called worldly concerns. So worldly concerns would be things like greed or lust or hate. So maybe it's unfortunate to call those worldly concerns, but that's kind of the way that division is often described. Rather, the person has other values that the person really represents. And it can be a surprise for someone who grows up in a culture that is, or a family or society that's governed so much by worldly concerns, to realize that there's a whole other way of living, that you don't have to go gung-ho for a career in order to get as much money as you possibly can. Maybe there's a whole other approach to life which is not based on money, which is very valuable and important. So the teacher is also initiator of someone, opens the door for someone to another way of life, another way of being. And this will often touch people's hearts, touch people into the depth of who they are. That's different than teaching them how to calm down a little bit by stress reduction, or which is valuable, but it just augments their life or supports their life. Initiator into a new way of life means a new way of life. Like, you know, it's kind of like sometimes it's very dramatic before and after. What people's life is oriented around, the values, the sense of purpose, has changed dramatically. So for some people, some teachers will initiate certain individuals into a whole different way of life. And again, here also it's a matter of degree. Sometimes it's small degrees that shift happens, and sometimes it's revolutionary for the person. And it's like day and night, before and after, how they live their life and what they do. This is a great story. I like this story. It's a good story for me to to be careful as a teacher. There was a English Buddhist teacher. I think he was in the 1960s, late 50s, early 60s. And he was kind of apparently somewhat, back then there wasn't a lot of Buddhism in England. He was English. And so he had read a lot, studied a lot, was part of the Buddhist society, Buddhist society or club in England, association. And he started teaching, and he would go around and lecture on Buddhism. It was apparently went pretty well for him, and he'd give these lectures and teach the English about Buddhism. And then in the middle of one of his public lectures, he said something like, or he heard himself say something like, if you really understand this, you'd practice it. And apparently he just stopped, stunned. And the next day he took a plane to Thailand and became a monk. So the idea, so he gets initiated himself. it took a while, but he... So sometimes, the how a person is, what they're pointing to or what they kind of represent something very meaningful for other people, and that's what kind of, what's transmitted or what's kind of moves them or supports them or inspires them to do this, something similar for themselves. But as people see the possibility of developing themselves, maturing themselves, living a new way of life, moving a new direction in life, it can be very hard to do that. And so the old pull of worldly values, of greed, hate, and delusion, or fear, of clinging to self, all the things we hold on to, can be quite strong. And also, as can be the tremendous power of self-delusion, that it's very easy to not see many, many things that about ourselves that keep us stuck in certain ways of thinking, things we believe about ourselves, things we believe about the world, about the nature of life, the way that our relationship to our emotions, our relationship to other people. There's a lot of different things that go on that we don't see, that we're blind to. And that make it difficult for that growth, that change to happen, to develop well. And so part of the function of teachers is to also to be to work closely, one-on-one with people, and engage very closely with their inner process, with their psychology, with their attachment, with their potential for growth. And that can make for a very rich relationship between the student and the teacher. It varies a lot from student to teacher and from different times in a person's life. But it also depends a lot on how much the student brings to the teacher and offers to the teacher, or asks the teacher to be involved in their life. But in this regard, teachers can probe, they can point out, they can say, look, you have a problem here. You're not looking at this, you need to look more carefully. I've had the amazing privilege It's a privilege, I guess, or permission, which very few people, I think, in ordinary life have permission to say this and get away with it without someone being angry or upset. But rather than people being angry or upset with me when I've said it, people have been really grateful. So now you're curious, what is it he says? So I've told people that they were conceited. that got someone's attention. That they're conceited. And I get away with it. I think the context of my saying that is really clear, that I'm trying to support them. I've accepted them. I'm supporting them. I'm their champion. I'm not trying to be mean to them or, you know, hit them over the head with some statement. I'm trying to say something that's meant to be helpful, to point something out, to help them move through it, to move into something new. And that's a strong thing to say to someone. And I have to say it very carefully, at the right time, in the right place. I just go down the street here in Redwood City and point to people. So sometimes teachers can be very direct and very powerful and challenging things. Some teachers will do that without hardly any permission at all. And some teachers will wait a long time until it's really clear that a relationship of trust has built up. A context for it is clear, that the student is kind of asking for that level of direct contact. Because without that clear kind of permission or contract for that kind of way of the relationship's being, maybe it's not appropriate, and so the teacher backs off. I know some Buddhist teachers who just don't prefer not to be involved that closely with students. They prefer to sit, be removed and apart, and not get so intimately involved with the details of people's psychology and life. But there's different preferences that people have. In this regard also, as teachers kind of point out challenges that we have to look at and deal with, some teachers can do this in a way that they're a real pain in the ass. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard a number of times that in Judaism, or corners of Judaism, they say that if a rabbi has, if half the congregation is not angry with the rabbi is not doing her job. Is that something right? Has somebody heard that? You've heard something like that, yeah, the Jews here? Sounds right. And I haven't aspired for that around here. but maybe that's my shortcoming. Maybe we'd be a much more dynamic and valuable Buddhist center if most of you were angry with me. But the problem is that you wouldn't come back. See, I could be an effective teacher who had you angry with me if you came back to really work it out, and work through it. But since you'd probably just go someplace else, and I can't be getting you angry too often. Doesn't work. In Zen, they have a teaching that there are two styles of being a teacher. There's many styles, but two interesting ones. One is called the granting way, and the other is the withholding way. And the granting way is when someone is just supportive and very accepting, and points out how wonderful you are, and here you go, take this, receive this teaching, do this, just grants, supports, kind. The withholding way just says no, in all kinds of ways. No, you can't have it. You can't do that. You don't do that. You shouldn't do that. You're just conceited. Drop it. And sometimes the withholding way can be very stern, very strict. And some Buddhist teachers, I think of it, associated most with Zen, but I've seen it in other places as well, where the teachers are quite stern. And they don't have a lot of students, because you have to really want to study with them. And you have to kind of work through that or see the value of someone who's stern and had the withholding way, because you're up against yourself. And when I practiced in Burma, I had two teachers there, Upandita and Ulakana, And they represented those two ways. Upandita was more the withholding way. He was very strict, very stern. He'd raise his eyebrow and, you know, you'd cower. He was like this like bulldog kind of guy, and tough and strong and easily dismiss you from the interview. Okay, it's enough now, go. And the Ulakana was just so kind. He was like, you know, like people would often refer to him as motherly or grandmotherly because of his love and his kindness. And you could do no wrong with him. Everything was accepted and wonderful, and you were great, and you felt like you had this supportive person. And for me, I practiced with both, and both had their role for me and were very important. The Upandita really challenged me and challenged me to kind of go further and deeper and make a certain kind of effort. Ulakana has helped me to relax and to soften, and that combination of the strictness and the softness worked really well for me. So then there's a whole other thing that goes on, the role for teachers, and that is that teachers are, and I've heard this expression from a Christian clergy, they are screens for projection. And usually not blank screens, but but screens for projection, meaning that people have all kinds of ideas about who that person is that are nothing to do with the person, but are projected up on the person. And so, if you think, if a person thinks that a teacher is an embodiment of full, perfect enlightenment, and we project that full enlightenment to the person, then if the person farts, then that's interpreted as being a divine fart. And the person can do no wrong, you know. Everything that's wrong in the person is somehow reinterpreted as being, oh, that must be crazy wisdom. That's a wonderful excuse for a lot of interesting behavior. There might be projection that, sometimes called transference, for example, that you're looked upon as a parental figure, that this is a person who's going to be my savior, be the person who's going to I can relate to as the way I would to a father or a mother. And so whatever that relationship was, it might be a problematic relationship, it might have been a beneficial relationship, but then sometimes the expectation that that relationship will continue with a spiritual teacher. And so that plays itself out. Sometimes it's projections that power struggles, whereas the feeling that people feel like, I've had that with me here at IMC, where many years ago, where someone was really in a power position with me, struggling to really wanted to take the power, the authority away to himself from me, and it was really inappropriate if someone walk off the streets. but I felt really strange. Suddenly, found myself in this, a power struggle with someone, and I think that here, was a certain projection of this is, Gil has the power, and it's not appropriate, and I'm going to take it away. I'm going to want it for myself. And then there's projections of being bad. This person's really terrible. And sometimes it swings quite dramatically. The more idealistic the projection is for the teacher, the more the person fulfills our ideal image of a savior or a divine person or a spiritual person or a good person or a wonderfully wise person. And then they fart too many times, and then it swings to the other side. And then this becomes, the person becomes the worst person and the terrible person. And there's a lot of anger that goes on. And the projection swing can swing back and forth quite intensely. And it might have nothing to do with the teacher. The teacher maybe hasn't changed much, but the swing goes within the person. I'm saying a lot today about Western religions. I hope it's being respectful enough. I have a lot of respect for these. When I've been in kind of interfaith dialogue with especially Christians, One of the things stands out to me, not being a Christian, not really growing up as a Christian, not knowing much about Christianity kind of from the inside, what stands out to me is how strongly Christians are about being in relationship to God. With something, it's a lot of it has to do about a relationship to something that's really other, for the most part. Something divine, whatever God is, something transcendent, something. And that relationship is really paramount, you know. And so when Christians sometimes have asked me about Buddhism, they're trying to understand it in terms of that relationship to the divine or the transcendent or something that's beyond self. And when they find out that Buddhism is, you know, you can make an argument or make a presentation of Buddhism that offers that a little bit, that there's some relationship to something which is sacred. But Buddhism has a lot to do with focusing on developing oneself. It's very, in certain sense, individualistic. In that we're looking at developing our own heart, our mind, overcoming the clinging, the grasping, the greed, hate, and delusion in our own mind, so that our own mind is liberated and awake from these forces. And so from certain Christian ears hearing this, it seems that Buddhism is very selfish. It's self-absorbed. Because somehow being self-sacrificing is important in certain schools of Christianity, and then having this relationship where we surrender ourselves or give ourselves over or a subservient relationship, or a lot of different ways it appears in Christianity, is a really important part of Christianity. So is this more or less okay what I said, kind of the people who have been trained in theology and seminaries? Is this okay? Am I okay? Okay, I'm asking the clergy and the monastics here, Christian monastics and clergy in the room. Oh, but here it says, yes.
Yeah, Gil and I are friends, and I'm working on translating his book for him to Spanish, but I'm trained in theology, but I think the difference so much isn't so much that Christians would see Buddhists as being selfish in that point, more that Christians would say Buddhists aren't seeing that you probably can't overcome certain things on your own. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the difference, that you
Great.
Need help to overcome certain things.
Great.
But the effort to look inside is maybe useful, but it's not enough.
Great. So thank you. Yeah. That's a great thing to have said now in this talk about teachers, because part of the function of teachers is to help us because of that limitation that most people have. It's very hard for an individual to see themselves really accurately and clearly. And so sometimes teachers have this important role. However, one of the points I was trying to say is that sometimes that relationship to a teacher, to some degree in the West, it tends to be very relational focused in a certain kind of way. It's kind of interesting. It's very West has a very strong emphasis on relationship and a strong emphasis on being an individual, and those two things live in tension with themselves. But when some people want to relate to a Buddhist teacher, they're looking some way to fulfill or complete some relationship that they have, whether it's a psychological need coming from family or whatever, a personal development, or whether it's a religious need coming from the religious idea that religion is about fulfilling a relationship. They're looking to fulfill and complete a relationship. Some Buddhist teachers, some Buddhist traditions, especially like Tibetan Buddhism, I think of, certain Zen traditions, the relationship with the teacher is a very important part of the whole process. In Theravadan teaching, the relationship with the teacher is not as important. It's not so central. In fact, in Tibetan Buddhism, they sometimes say there are four refuges. There's three refuges that we have, Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And sometimes in Tibetan Buddhism, they say that the fourth refuge is the guru, meaning your teacher. In Theravadan Buddhism, if they mention a fourth refuge, it's not the guru, but rather it's yourself. So it's a kind of very different kind of approach. So whereas the relationship can be important in Theravadan Buddhism, insight meditation, it doesn't held up institutionally or theologically kind of as being so important. But even so, students come to a teacher looking to be in a relationship in many different kinds of ways. And part of the role of the teacher is to sometimes participate in that, but sometimes not, and let the student struggle and bounce off that and realize that they're looking for things that shouldn't be, you know, looking for a parental role in the teacher, or they're looking for all kinds of things in the teacher that, you know, and the teacher, you know, maybe doesn't react to it or doesn't do it. And so then it bounces back and the teacher becomes a mirror. And the very frustrations that you have with the teacher are maybe the kind of very things the way we need to learn, because we realize the teacher's not going to give me that. So I need to look at what it is I'm looking for and trying to get. When I was a new student, Zen student, one of the reasons I went to live at the San Francisco Zen Center was that the senior teachers there, when I spent time with them, I would play these social games. I would talk and act in ways to try to get an effect from them, have them see me a certain way. And generally, the way I talked and behaved worked with my friends, you know, to get a certain effect. But with them, it didn't work. You know, they were just kind of a little bit. I would say something, and it was met with kind of silence or non-participation or something. And the result of that was that I saw myself more clearly, and I thought, this is great. I want to be around these people, so that I can see myself and not act like this, not behave this way, because it doesn't feel good to behave this way. So these are at least some of the functions that a Buddhist teacher has. And so someone who's a student, someone in training, has a range of different needs or desires or wishes in regard to the practice, that so that when they come to spend time with a teacher, to learn from a teacher, what they bring with them is their particular purpose of practice, what they're trying to do. They bring their own psychology and background. They bring their own hang-ups and attachments and problems. They bring to some degree their own cultural background ideas of what it means to be a student, what it means to be a teacher. And all those things come into the mix, together with the personality of the teacher, together with the interests of the teacher, together with the capacities of the teacher, the understanding of the teacher. And so there's many, many factors that come into play when two people meet as a teacher and a student. And so so who is the teacher and who's the student? What is a teacher and what is a student? I like to tell people that it's the student that makes the teacher. That there is no teacher before there's a student. Like I'm just, you know, Gil kind of bumbling around Redwood City. You know, concerned about getting the oil change in my car and whatever needs to happen until someone, you know, bumps into me and says, you know, says something that, you know, relates to me as a teacher, and I respond then. But I don't go around thinking of myself as a teacher until, you know, there's occasion for it. So a student makes a teacher. So how does a student come? What does a student come with? What do they bring? And so what I find is that the student teacher, well, the nature of who I am as a teacher, is in part defined by who comes to me and what their needs and situation is. And so my role as a teacher is constantly morphing and changing. And so in a sense, each student and teacher creates a different student and teacher, creates a different relationship. There is no set relationship that there has to be. There's many different relationships that there can be. And in fact, not only is it a different relationship for every student and teacher, there's probably a different relationship every time the student and teacher meets. There's a different kind of way, the relationship that goes on. It also means that it's very difficult to compare, you know, or dangerous to compare different student-teacher stories with your own, because there are different needs. I've had students who I felt have gone really far and really deeply in practice, who've kind of been my students in a sense, but I've had very little to do with them, personally. But it's really clear they've taken the teaching, they've practiced, and, you know, offered some support. But there's not much, you know, personal contact going on. And other times where I feel there's a tremendous amount of personal contact and closeness going on. And is one right and one not right? It's just different chemistry, different situations, different things that come into play that go on. So now it's 10:45. So the last thing I'll say, maybe because of the time, we tend to use the word student in our tradition. Sometimes we use the word practitioner. And we tend not to use the word disciple. And but it might be interesting to look a little bit at the word disciple. And what does that imply? That's different than student, different than practitioner. And what does that say? What does that suggest or imply in terms of a relationship between the student and teacher? So I hope this was interesting, and to kind of explain a little bit how it works in our kind of scene. I'm sure there's lots of questions, and I'm sure I could go on and on. There's a lot more to say, but there's time to stop, so hopefully it's been adequate enough.